I want to thank you, Pat, on behalf of everybody here. I told you he was an articulate and charismatic speaker, and I'm sure you would agree. I particularly appreciate your a different viewpoint of some of us, and we've been on the Conservation Commission and the Planning Board. I know several from the town of Peterborough Planning Board here today have looked at, are looking at growth in terms of technological and economic point of view. But it is refreshing and highly instructive that you have brought to fore these other ways of dealing with growth, and we thank you very much. Pat's very kindly offered to answer some questions. Would you please stand up and speak clearly, and Pat will repeat the question and answer it.
Yes. Yes, the question is whether I can name some places that have successfully used the land trust system. Yes, indeed. In fact, New Hampshire is one of the pioneers in that system. There are a number of towns in the state. The Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests has been one of the groups doing this. Perhaps the best example that they have, however, is where they went into northern Maine, into an entire series of townships, of unincorporated townships. By turning the vast majority of the land in this region into a land trust, and then by setting aside a small corner of it for some future development and some, in this case, forest industry use, they were able to convert this whole area into a completely managed transition to growth. I don't remember how many square miles were involved, but there were many. In the western part of the country, there are state after state that are beginning to use the land trust system. There is a land trust in the town of Exeter. There is another land trust. Oh, it's in the Connecticut River Valley, and I'm sorry the name of the town fails me. And there's a lot of information available on this in New Hampshire from the Society and from others. In fact, there's now a statewide initiative going to begin soon called the Trust for New Hampshire Land, which is going to try and deal with this on a statewide basis. And then part of its work will also be to work with communities like the ones in the Monadnock region to show you the benefits of doing it. I should also tell you that I am in the process of setting up a land trust in my own neck of the woods. I live on a dirt dead-end road looking off at a mountain over in the seacoast, which is nice. It's just that in the last 15 years, once you turn off 101 to go up to the farm, there are now 45 more dwellings than there were 15 years ago. Needless to say, this is of some concern, and so we are now in the process of buying, as a group, the rest of the vacant land, and in most cases, as I said earlier, we are not able to go in and just buy it. We get an option. This is nice. We don't have to tie our money up. When there's a death or a transfer, we have a first refusal. Then we make the financial arrangements, buy the land, decide where there can be some economic use of it in order to get the money back to pay the price, and we end up with far fewer developed areas and a large area of undeveloped land. Yes?
Are there communities in New Hampshire that have successfully implemented the orientation program you talk about, and do they work with other towns, or is it just on an individual town basis?
Well, of course, you've hit on the great New Hampshire question, and that is it all right for somebody who lives in Peterborough to work with somebody who lives in Jaffrey? And pick your towns. I didn't mean to select you two. I think there are some examples of some incipient community organizations of this type. The best examples we have come from the large cities. Grand Rapids, Michigan, for example, a town I happen to grow up in. The city government actually organized the community or stimulated the organization of the community into neighborhood associations. They have two maps. They have a map of the electoral wards and the school districts, and they have another map of the neighborhood organizations. The town of Exeter has now, I think, four of these neighborhood organizations, all of them, by the way, in that part of the town that still has open land for growth. I think this is a relatively new idea. That doesn't stop me from proposing it to you, because I don't know anybody else that faces quite the situation that you do. Most of the rest of us in New Hampshire are either too far away to worry, or the damage is already done. I think the Monadnock region, in my opinion, is probably the last chance. And so, It may be a relatively new idea, but we know from other uses, school, college, corporations, that this kind of orientation works.
Do you have any thoughts about the need for balanced economic housing for low-income, middle-income, as well as more wealthy people, and how a community like this might do that?
Well, you know, that's a problem that I understand very well, because we've done a lot of professional work around that. It's also one that bothers me, because my experience is that that is a relatively easy one to solve, provided that you solve it with advanced planning. Those communities which have said, look, today there's going to be a need for some low-income housing, and then go ahead and plan it, end up generally with pretty good low-income housing. And there are just all kinds of examples of this in the state of New Hampshire itself, to say nothing of other states. Those communities who say, well, nothing doing, we're going to have everything up here at this level, end up ultimately with low-income housing spread all over the place, sometimes in the very worst places. The only way I know to deal with it, however, is to attack the issue head-on. The examples of successful low-income housing that have been done by private developers, and by that I mean development corporations who depend on reporting a quarterly profit and so forth, are few and far between. The examples of those done by community groups or by the local government itself are really many. The problem is not doing it. It's that first problem of, can you agree that you're going to have some? And I've been as vociferous in trying to do something to modulate the growth of New Hampshire as anybody. And I have to say, it always bothers me ethically and humanly when I go to towns that just don't want any of that middle and lower income growth. If you want to end up like Stamford, Connecticut, that's the way to do it. Stamford, Connecticut has the school situation because they have two types of housing. They have public subsidized housing and housing that starts in the low 250,000s. Take your pick. In fact, I computed when I was there last time that it would be cheaper for me to stay at the local Hilton 365 days a year than to try and buy something in Stamford.
One comment. As a newcomer, I very much appreciate your comments about orientation. I would add that people who choose to come to this area do come with values that are not all that different from the values that you're talking about inculcating. There's a reason that they came.
Yep.
Just like there's a reason that we choose our spouses.
Absolutely.
It's all logical. It's a lot, really shared perception. My question is unrelated to my comment, and that is, one thing that does happen when this kind of economic growth goes on is that that farming as an occupation tends to suffer. I understand that Peterborough just lost its last working dairy. Do you have any thoughts on how agriculture in particular can be preserved as a functioning occupation in this area?
The question is, how can agriculture be preserved in this area? I think the answer is crystal clear from experience. First, I think I already mentioned I have a blueberry farm in the Seacoast region. I have been working in this whole business of preserving farmland in the state, including the laws that we have gotten passed here, for about 20 years. The problem is that nothing is going to save American agriculture except probably a total restructuring. And I say that as a counsel to the American agriculture industry, whose coalition is a client of ours. We in New England end up being fortunate. If we want to save agricultural land, it's going to have to be saved with small, local market garden crops that can be sold in the adjacent towns. That's what's going to save agricultural land. Beyond that, I think our chances are very slim. And now you are talking, in terms of those who farm that land, about slavery. It's just simple slavery. If you've got a garden or a small fruit crop and you're trying to sell it in the local town with the mechanization that's available on a small farm, you know that it's sun up, sun down, 365 days a year. And so we're going to have to find a way. One of the things we're working on over in the seacoast is to at least mitigate that a little bit by perhaps some of our land trusts buying the farmland and then making it possible for young people who are really gung-ho to farm, who want to spend their lives farming. They don't care if they make a fortune, they just want to work the land. And there are a lot of those people, or some of them anyway. We're trying to help them get onto the land, because the ones who are just committed agriculturalists most of the time don't happen to have $300,000-$400,000 kicking around in some bank account. It's the only way I know. Local intensive farming that you can sell in the community. If you're going to truck it even to Boston, you're now getting into a size that is probably going to have intense problems. Absolutely. The question is, what are we going to do about water resources and these other statewide problems that are no respecters of town boundaries? I would suggest, however, that those kind of resources often are respecters of geographic region boundaries, and to at least some extent, the Monadnock region is enclosed a little bit. You still obviously have relationships with your neighboring regions, but you're better off than, say, any single town in the region. Again, it would be nice to think that the state government was going to take this problem seriously and do some things about it, and obviously it's up to all of us to keep that pressure on. More and more, I am becoming a relier on the local initiative, on regional cooperation, and not depending on things that come out of Concord.
Ah.
There is a study. There's an ongoing study. It was begun in the 1930s. It has, as they like to say in state government, quote, fairly good, unquote, information. In the town next to ours, when we went looking for that huge aquifer that was going to supply all the water for the town, now that the old well was gone, we found out that it had leaked out since the study was done in 1938, and you may find some of those. But yes, there is such data, not nearly enough. You know, if you want to talk about that kind of thing, you really have to talk about the tax structure in New Hampshire. It's just an unavoidable problem. When we decide that we are independent enough Yankees to pay our own taxes and to stop living off Massachusetts and Connecticut residents, we may have enough money in our state coffers to do those studies. In the meantime, I just don't think we're going to have the dough. It's just not in the cards. New Hampshire's typical reliance on the property tax has certainly got to be one of the major enemies in this whole subject. I recently purchased a piece of property in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which, again, their growth problems make ours look rather silly. In 1955, Albuquerque was the size of Concord, and in 1985, it is now bigger than Providence, Rhode Island. You talk about growth. And yet my property taxes there, I think my property taxes this year on a relatively costly house are going to be $400, $400. And the sales tax there is like 3%. I don't even notice it. There's no income tax in the state. It's just, you know, that's another subject that maybe the Lyceum would want to look into. Then you can really draw a crowd, and you better have the fours sit on that side, though, and the beginners on that side, and some referees down the middle, because it's a pretty tough subject. Yes.
I'm from Maine, and we have similar problems. And I would cite the example of the development and acquisition of our offshore islands, mm-hmm. very attractive pieces of real estate. You mentioned, of course, interior Maine. I think what we have happened in the state of Maine is that we've had the inaccessibility to many of the more desirable areas of the state. Mm-hmm. And some of our growth plans have been along the sociological or political lines, which I suggest to you are very time-consuming to implement.
Absolutely.
Now, this region is highly accessible to virtually any American citizen. Mm-hmm. And my question to you is, given that you speak highly of sociological and political solutions, and you are highly accessible, how do you deal with the factor of time, mm-hmm. in the sense that perhaps no matter what is done, if you choose the correct choice, you are facing the problems of simply time passing by where change will happen before understanding of sociological processes, of reward systems and punishment systems, and new social organizations to control this. In Maine, we have a natural impediment to growth in that many of our prime areas are virtually inaccessible. Certainly, it's very difficult to get out to an offshore island unless you're privately equipped with your own yacht.
The question is, isn't it too, I'm phrasing this, tell me if it's wrong. The question is, isn't it too time-consuming and too difficult to try and implement these social or political solutions to this problem? And the example was given of Maine, which has the wonderful benefit of having a lot of its choice areas be inaccessible. Well, there's really two answers to that. You may not be familiar, many of you are familiar with the study that was done in the region, must be 10 years ago now, about how to preserve it. And you'll recall that the only answer for preserving the region was to either, we had two choices. You could make the schools bad so nobody would want to come, or you could absolutely make sure that all the highways went to pot so nobody could drive here. And we were about, as I recall, to take a poll in the region on which of those choices people wanted, but we decided against it. I think the answer to your question is that, yeah, it is time-consuming. Dealing with people as humans is always time-consuming. But now let's think of some subjects where we haven't done that. Our solution to nationhood, to world aggression, to violence and war, has always been economic, made a lot of jobs for a lot of folks, or we want the real estate next door, or whatever the economic push was, or it's been technical. Well, we need to do it. It's something we can do. It's more powerful than the last. And I think you can only need to look around the world today and see what happens when you apply only or mainly economic and technical solutions. There is no doubt that if you try to integrate, to orient new people into your region, it's going to take some energy. It's going to take some time. To me, however, the fact that it's going to take a lot of people working together to set up the system of the neighborhoods and the networks is its greatest strength. Because now, instead of a few folks who are elected or self-appointed or whatever carrying the cudgels, we now start truly being a community. We are organized, working together on a single purpose. And when that kind of a relationship entity goes forth and meets newcomers, as was pointed out, who probably already share a good number of your values, they just need to have those reinforced and to learn the rest of the details. Now you're talking again about a community. So we're back really to that basic question. If we care about dealing with the impacts of growth, then we need to prove it, not by our words, not by our attitudes, but by our behaviors. We need to do something. It's an unfortunate fact of human life that we can either complain or we can do something. And there's so much going on in the world that I think most of us, including certainly yours truly, too often opt to complain. So all I can offer you is a method that I am fairly convinced will work. I've seen it work too many times, but you're going to have to do it. That means you're going to have to put some time in it, some commitment in it. And if you don't, well, put your farm up for sale and you can join the rest of the developers. Yes, ma'am. The question is, how can small communities prepare themselves for someone with a development plan who may have beautiful architectural drawings and talk of all this, the economic benefits that are going to come to everybody. Well, I think, and by the way, we have some wonderful examples of that in the state of New Hampshire. I think probably the greatest example of architectural drawings used to persuade has to be the drawings that were brought before the Seacoast Regional Planning Commission when I was its chairman to build the Seabrook Nuclear Plant. Here was this wonderful facility, this electrical facility, and here were these trees arching up over it. Well, you know, you're right. You get so enamored of this. Everybody looked at that and said, well, that isn't so bad, until one cool-headed member said, sir, what kind of trees are those? Are those redwoods? Because literally, they would have had to have been giant redwoods to have arched up over the plant. And you're right. This is a technique, very unfairly, that's really a sort of lying by drawing that can overwhelm a community. I think that we're doing some things now. We have a regional planning commission. If you didn't vote for it and try and give it some money and don't serve on it, then don't complain if it doesn't do all it should do. But you do have a regional planning commission. We now, as Phil mentioned, have a fairly good local infrastructure in most towns in the state. We do have planning boards. We do have conservation commissions. Most towns have historical societies. I wish historical societies could become more forward-looking and not just totally backward-looking, and I say that as the former president of one local historical society. We have some of those mechanisms. What we don't have is anything that pulls people all together so they can share their perceptions, and that's what I'm talking about. If such a developer comes in and a group of us are already working through this network, and we see the perceptions that, hey, maybe it isn't just the way it's painted. Now we have an informal mechanism for dealing with it. Too often the formal mechanisms are totally overwhelmed. The planning board, a group of local volunteers, sits there while six Philadelphia lawyers work it over. If you've ever been on a planning board or a regional planning commission, you know how true that is. And it ain't fair. I mean, we cannot expect to be able to fight that off. So we've got some mechanisms. We need more. Yes, go ahead.
One more question. The author and the publisher of the book you mentioned.
You can see that the questioner, fortunately, is still in touch with the technical system and the speaker is not. She needs the important details, which I omitted. The author, it's a group, actually. The main author is a man named Robert Bella, B-E-L-L-A-H, who's a very interesting sociologist at the University of California. And the publisher looks to me like Harper and Row. Thank you. One more question. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
And that might be a way for the cities and towns and the planning boards to limit their goals when we are waiting the outcome of that particular study that is being done. It will be calculated by the university system.
Right. The point is being made that we do have a groundwater, what that is actually is just the latest step in the groundwater mapping that's been going on for years and years rather slowly, and that this may help us. I certainly hope it does help us limit growth. You probably know of the plans to build a dike between Lake Winnipesaukee and Dover and Portsmouth to help them get a little more water. It's similar to the plan to tap the Great Lakes down into some of the water-poor regions. I think it's a little more than just knowing where the water is. The question is keeping it. Thank you very much.
That gentleman up there.
All right. Excuse me. You shouldn't wear a blue suit and sit in the back, you see. It's
some years ago, I was involved in the land use plan issue down in Massachusetts and now on the West Coast, but I came back in the summer, so I'm interested in this issue. One of the ideas which was put forward at the time, I don't know if it's ever come to any fruition, was the concept of transferable development rights as a means of allowing landowners to retain their economic interests and preserve ecologically sensitive areas, but who then, by selling the rights, maintain lower property values and allow growth where it's more ecologically appropriate.
The question is whether so-called TDRs, transferable development rights, are being used anywhere. They are being used in Vermont. As a matter of fact, they are one of the bases for some of the planning regions in Vermont. And as I'm sure you know, they are being used on Long Island in Suffolk County. That's the basis of their plan. I see several people in the audience who helped, who along with me lobbied hard for such a system in New Hampshire. I think our legislature was somewhat unreceptive to the idea. They preferred cash when sales took place. I'm sorry to say I don't think so. And unfortunately, in the state of New Hampshire, unless the state were to pass such a law, it's probably not possible legally for a community to do it. But notice that the idea of TDRs, or at least that idea, that approach, is implicit in what I'm talking about. It's a sort of a personal community way of dealing with the issue. It's a way, for example, that a land trust can substitute. The land trust movement in the state, by the way, came about as a result of the failure of transferable development rights. What a land trust does is it just transfers the rights itself right within its own property and thereby helps to effect a similar transfer in neighboring properties. That's another technique that that we just don't have available to us, which is really why I propose the ones I do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Du Bois, and thank you, Mr. Jackson. You've been listening to Patrick Jackson speaking on the impact of growth on the Monadnock region. Those present here at the Unitarian Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, are invited to stay and meet our guest at an informal reception. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely by contributions. If you wish to assist, we will accept with gratitude your check made out to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, Box 543, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. Our live audience will find bowls located near the exits for their convenience. Our guest next week will be South African political activist and member of the African National Congress, Ernest F. Dubé. The beautiful flowers decorating the platform today were presented by Margot Johnson. Thank you for being with us. I'm Larry Barnes.